Several years ago, when Isaiah was little, we were at a get-together at some friend's house. A lot of people were there, and some kids, including Isaiah, were playing in the driveway, and I was sitting with some of the moms up on the porch, kind of at a distance from the driveway, and we're watching the kids play, and Isaiah fell, which he did a lot back then. Isaiah fell. And so he felt a little bit, he looked kind of hard. And so the moms went, like that. And they kind of looked at me to see what I was going to do. And so I sat there, I didn't move. And I yelled across the yard, "Get up!" And they kind of looked at me. And Isaiah kind of laid there for a minute. And so I yelled again, "Get up!" And he got up. I kind of whimpered a little, brushed himself off, and went on. You know, you can usually tell as a parent when there's been real damage done and when there hasn't, and you can't baby him too much. You got to kind of toughen him up a little, and so he was fine. But fast forward several years ahead to just a few months ago, my family and I, some of us, were out at the Sound, and we were sitting on the beach in beach chairs, and my daughter was jumping into the water, and she jumped in and injured herself very badly. Both of her ankles were injured very badly. And she came up out of the water, and I couldn't tell what she was yelling about, if she was excited or happy or what was going on. And so I sat there and looked at her for a minute, and finally Tracy said, "I think she's hurt." Well, you can imagine what I did. I didn't sit in my chair. I didn't yell, "Get up." Right? Now, you probably understand part of why that is. That's my girl, and I don't want to do that to her. The other reason was that I could tell that she was seriously injured. The way she was acting, I could tell that she was badly hurt. And so I got up, and I went to her because she was helpless, because she could not handle her own situation. She could not help herself. And so I got up, and I went to her to help. In the Bible, when we see Jesus seated, or when we see Jesus rather at God's right hand, which we do several times in Scripture, Jesus is pictured in heaven at God's right hand. Normally, when we see him there, what is his physical position? What is his posture? Normally, he is seated. For instance, and if you want to turn here, we're going to get to Acts 7 in a moment, but if you want to turn to the book of Hebrews, we read in Hebrews chapter 10 this comparison between the Old Testament priesthood and Jesus. And it says in the Old Testament that every priest stands daily and offering time after time the same sacrifices which can never take away sins. What is the physical posture of the Old Testament priest? He's standing. Why is he standing? Because he's got a job to do. And that job is never done. He's got to stand how many days? Every day. And he's got to keep doing what? He's got to keep offering sacrifice, because the job is never done. But the Hebrew writer, demonstrating to us once again that when we read the Bible, we need to notice every single word that they're using, because every single word is important. You can't skip over words or take it for granted that we know what it's saying. But he says about Jesus, "But he," Jesus, "having offered one sacrifice for sins for all time," did what? Sat down. What is his physical posture? He is seated at the right hand of God. Notice the contrast between the priest who's standing and Jesus who is seated. Can you imagine going into your job tomorrow and your boss telling you, "We purchased a recliner for you. You have done your job so well, you don't need to do it anymore. From now on, you'll be sitting. Every time you come to work, you're going to sit you down and you're not going to have to work anymore. Because when you did your job, you did it so well, it is forever done." Women, can you imagine coming home one day and your husband, your children saying to you, "We bought you a recliner. We want you to sit down, never cook another meal, never dust another table, never vacuum another floor. Because you have done your job so perfectly, all you're going to do from now on is sit down. That's not how it works with us. We don't get to sit down and stop moving. But it says that Jesus is seated at the right hand of God. There's another contrast, similar contrast in Hebrews 1, where he's talking about the angels. And he says in Hebrews 1:14 that the angels are spirits, notice what he says, who are sent out. They have to leave where they are and go and do a job. They're sent out to serve. The contrast is with Jesus. To which of the angels did God ever say, like he did to Jesus, what? Sit at my right hand. God sends the angels out to do a job. But Jesus is seated at the right hand of God. We know that the royal family has people to cook and clean. Did you know that the royal family has people designated to break in their shoes? If you're a royal, you don't have to break in your shoes. Somebody do that for you. If you're a royal, you don't have to put toothpaste on your toothbrush. When you go into the bathroom at night before you go to bed, it's already done for you. Somebody puts toothpaste on there for you. Pretty sweet. If you're a royal, you get to sit there and tell a whole household of other people. You know how many servants the queen had when she died? 1,133. If you got 1,133 servants, you don't have to do nothing. If you're a royal, you get to sit there and tell everybody else, go do that, go do that, and go do that. And you probably got people, you probably don't have to speak. You probably have people who speak for you and say, go do that for him. That's what it's like to be a royal. You get to sit there and other people do stuff for you. It's significant. It's easy to overlook that word sit or the word seated. Don't overlook that. Jesus is at the right hand of God, and he is seated at the right hand of God. Except. There is one occasion, if you want to turn to Acts chapter 7, there is one occasion where Jesus is pictured at the right hand of God, where he is not seated. What's he doing? He's standing at the right hand of God. It's in Acts chapter 7. You remember what was going on in Acts chapter 7. Stephen was a servant. The first time we see Stephen, he was a servant. One of seven men put in charge of food, serving food to widows for the church. Then the next time we see Stephen, what's he doing? He's preaching. Stephen has become an evangelist, and he's preaching to a group of Jews who get very upset about his preaching, and they take him before the officials. And as Stephen preaches to the officials, they get very angry, violently angry, physically. They're transformed in their anger. They're so angry. And they get so angry at Stephen that finally they determine to do what? They're going to kill him. They're so angry at Stephen, they're going to kill him. I would venture to say that as angry as you've ever been at somebody, you've never been that angry. How angry do you have to be to want to kill somebody? That's how angry they are. They've determined to kill Stephen. And they're about to get up and attack him and kill him. They're not concerned about doing it in a humane fashion. They're not concerned about cruel and unusual punishment. They're not going to give him lethal injection. They're going to stone him to death. They're going to throw big rocks at him until he dies. But before that can happen, the Bible says that Stephen was granted a vision into heaven. And it says in Acts 7, Stephen said, I see the heavens open, and the Son of Man, who is that? Jesus. Notice that he's at the right hand of God, but notice that his physical posture has changed. He is not seated at God's right hand. What is he doing? He is standing at God's right hand. It's the only time we see this. The only time we see Jesus at the right hand of God where he is standing. As Stephen, his servant, is about to be violently murdered, Jesus is seen standing. Why is that? Why do we have this image of Jesus at God's right hand at this moment standing? Why has he gotten up from his throne at this moment? You know, a lot of times when we see a president in the Oval Office, we see him in this setting, in this posture. Right? He's seated in the Oval Office behind a massive desk. And normally, I don't know that I've ever seen a picture of the president seated in the Oval Office behind his desk and other people sitting around him. What are they doing? They're standing. They're standing. You don't go in and grab a chair when the president's sitting in the Oval Office behind his... You don't go pull up a chair and go, "Hey, Prez, what's up? What's going on? How you been?" Why do we have so many of these pictures of U.S. presidents seated in the Oval Office behind a massive desk? Because the picture says what? Power. Authority. Even majesty, right? It's a picture of great power. But then we also have pictures like these. This picture of George W. Bush taken on 9/11. After 9/11, when crews were at ground zero, the rescue effort, I suppose, at this point had been ended. It was a recovery effort. All of those people dead, all of that destruction, all of that grief and sorrow, what did the president do? He got up from his seat. He got up from behind his desk, and he went and helped. He went and served, right? It is not appropriate for the president, after an event like 9/11, to just sit behind his desk. It's not appropriate. It's appropriate for the president to get up and to go help. And that's what George W. Bush did. And others have done as well. So, here's what we've been doing over the last month. We have talked about Jesus before he became a man, the eternal existence as God of Jesus in heaven. Last week we talked about Jesus leaving heaven to come to the earth to live as a human, noticing that Jesus is the only truly unique being in the universe. God who lived as a human on the earth. Nobody else ever did anything like that. And then what happened? Jesus died. He was raised. He ascended in Acts 1 back to heaven. And that's where he is right now. The question is, what's he doing? And that's what we're going to talk about. Even more importantly is not what he's doing. What difference does it make to you? And to be honest with you, it was my concern. I'm really excited when I decided to preach this series in this month. I was super excited about this. But even at that moment, and particularly over the last couple of weeks, as I've worked on this, my concern has been that we will look at all these amazing passages and all this truth, and the result of it will be, so what? Not because of your attitude, but because I will not have done a sufficient job of saying to you, here's why it matters. You know, I understand, I don't watch the news, but I understand last couple of weeks or so that our President Joe Biden was in Ukraine, I think. Is that right? Did he make a visit to Ukraine? I think. That's a big deal. Joe Biden, the most powerful and important person in the entire world, President of the United States, is in the Ukraine, arguably the most important place in the world right now. So you've got the most important person in the most important place. That's a big deal. You know how much impact that had on my life, moment by moment? You know how much that impacted me day by day? Do you know that during the time that Joe Biden was in the Ukraine, at not one point did I say, I've got this hearing problem that I've recently been diagnosed with. Now I've got to get a hearing aid. I've got this hearing issue I've got to deal with. But boy, Joe Biden's in the Ukraine. And so, you know, I didn't do that one time. You know, issues come up with my kids, this thing or that thing, one degree of seriousness or another. You know how many times I said to myself, well, this may be going on, but hey, Joe Biden's in the Ukraine. Not once. Because even the most important man in the most important part of the world really doesn't have any impact on me day to day. And what I don't want to happen is that by the time we're done this morning, I have told you that the most important person in the universe is in the most important place in the universe, and you go, so? And? So, it matters that Jesus is in heaven, and I hope that we will see why it matters. That's going to be our focus. Is Jesus currently at the right hand of God in heaven? And here's going to be the big idea. Here's what we're going to come back to time and time again. It is this: that Jesus was exalted to rule so that he could condescend to serve. Jesus was exalted to serve, to heaven, to rule, so that he could condescend to serve. I'm not in heaven. My problems aren't in heaven. My challenges aren't in heaven. I'm right here. And my problems and challenges and issues are at my house, my job, my money, my health, my body, my mind, my friends. That's where my problems are. Jesus is in heaven. My problems are here. What's the connection between those two? That's what we want to talk about. And what we're going to see is that Jesus gives us three things that all of us need. I wonder which one of these is going to be the thing that you need more than any. My suspicion is that of these three things that all of us need, there's going to be one of these things that you're going to look at this morning and think, that's the one. That's the one I'm really going to listen to. There's what I really need right now. We're going to see that Jesus, because he is in heaven, provides to us peace. That Jesus, because he is in heaven, provides to us forgiveness of sin. And that Jesus, because he is in heaven, provides to us our spiritual growth. Jesus provides our peace. Am I the only one who feels like the world has absolutely lost its mind? Is that just me? Can that just be me? Who feels like that it's absolutely gone off the rails? Like, not just off the rails, but like all the way out of the county, state, and country too. I mean, we've got all of this conflict and tension. And I know, and Neil was pointing something out in Bible class recently. It was just a super powerful point that he was making about back in the 60s and how things were. And there were some crazy times in the 60s. In a lot of ways, crazy they are now. But that's true. But in recent memory, can you imagine a time when people hated each other as much? When there was as much conflict or division, when there was as much tension as there is right now, when there was as much fear about where things are going? Can you remember a time in recent memory when there was an absolute rejection of what seemed to be solid and undeniable truths? Things like gender, things like marriage, things like basic issues of morality that now people are saying are just a matter of your own personal preference. It just seems bizarre, doesn't it? And then you throw in spy balloons, UFOs, people shooting guns at electrical substations. Who thinks of this? Who wakes up one day and goes, I'm tired of shooting bottles and deer, I'm going to go shoot up a substation? Who does that? But we've got all these weird things going on in our culture. And then, forget all that, there's all the craziness going on in your own life. I know that you come in here and you look very put together and you look very calm and you look very happy and it looks all good. I know better. I know better. I know better partly because I know you, a lot of you, and I know better. But just because I know you're a human being. And human beings have craziness. So you got all that big pile, that big mess, that big jumble of craziness that all of us have to deal with all the time. And at the very least, it's unsettling. At the worst, it's absolutely terrifying to get up in the morning and think, okay, what's it going to be today? Just the life we live. But you know what? We're not the first. We're not the first. We're about to begin to talk about, Lord willing, Revelation. You know why Revelation was written? Whatever else you think about or with Revelation or however else you're weirded about, whatever you think about Revelation, you know why it was written? It was written because there were people who were living in the exact same situation you're living in right now. Their world was upside down. In addition to their own personal issues, their government was violently against them, much more so than ours is at present. There was an entire religion dedicated to fighting them. Their culture was against everything that they believed in. And many of those churches had internal difficulties. And so John writes to the churches at Revelation. And he establishes, among other things, this very important truth. Jesus is King. Jesus is King. He says in Revelation 1:5, Jesus Christ, among other things, notice this, ruler of the kings of the earth. By definition, a king thinks that he or is the ultimate ruler. He's the king. If somebody was above him, he wouldn't be the king. But what does he say in Revelation 1? Jesus is the... So you've got the kings of the earth, but they've got a king too. And his name is Jesus. And it doesn't matter what that Roman emperor is going to try to do to you, or those local Roman governors are going to try to do to you. There's somebody above them who, even though it doesn't always seem like it, has things under control. Revelation 17:14, the Lamb. Who is that? Jesus. The Lamb is the Lord of lords and King of kings. It looks like everything's out of control. In fact, Jesus has it under control. Because Jesus is above all authority. Now, as Paul points out to us, this is obviously accepting God the Father. But other than God the Father, Jesus is above all authority. All authority has been given to me where, Jesus said? In heaven and on earth. He has been made ruler. He has been put above all things, Paul said in Ephesians 1, and has been given the name at which every knee will bow and every tongue confess. John was telling them that so they could experience peace. Because it seems like everything is absolutely out of control when in fact Jesus is very much in control. Jesus was exalted to be a king so that he could serve us and give us peace. Secondly, Jesus provides forgiveness. There are three things that Christians, in my experience, struggle mightily with. Number one is forgiveness of sin. They sin. They need to be forgiven. Right? All people do. They're struggling and they need help. But here's the big one. The big one is that Christians struggle with, and I see it all the time, and sometimes even experience it, not having our sins forgiven, not needing help in our struggles, but what? Believing we actually have it. This is the thing that Christians struggle with. Believe it or not, your sins, if you're a Christian, have been forgiven. There's no struggle to that. The sins are gone. Believe it or not, if you're a Christian, God is helping you in your struggle. There's no struggle in that. The struggle is believing that I've been forgiven. The struggle is believing that I've got help. So many Christians don't believe that they've been forgiven. And so what are they doing? Carrying the weight of their sins every day. How does that feel? Can you imagine if you were still carrying everything you'd ever picked up in your life? Everything you ever picked up. And instead of putting something else down, you just added it to the pile. And when it got too much to carry here, somebody put on a bag on your back and started piling stuff in there. And so now you're carrying all this stuff, and you got the bag back there behind you. You're weighted down. Your knees are shot. Your back hurts. You sweat all the time because you're carrying all this stuff. You say, that's ridiculous. Who would do that? Who would be crazy enough to never put something down that they can put down? I'll tell you who. Most Christians. Because most Christians I know are still carrying to some degree some of the sin that they have been forgiven of. Now here's what we do about that. We say to ourselves, well, you know, it's just, I can't imagine that I'm worthy of. I can't imagine I'm worthy. I can't imagine that God has. And so what does it look like? It looks like humility. You know what it is? A lack of faith. Don't think you're being humble. Don't think you're being humble when you say, well, I'm just not sure. I'm just not sure God could forgive me. That's not humility. It's faithlessness. Because the Bible says He forgave you. You're not believing the Bible. What is that? Lack of faith. That's all it is. So we struggle to believe. You know what else we struggle with? Believing that we have help when we're struggling. You know why? Because we can't feel it. So we put so much stock in our feelings. I don't feel forgiven, so I must not be. I don't feel like the Spirit is dwelling in me, so He must not be. I don't feel like God is helping me, so He must not be. Do you know how much your feelings are worth when it comes to spiritual truth? A big, fat zero. Not one thing. Feelings are worthless. Truth is all important. It doesn't matter if you feel it or not. If you're struggling with something and you're a Christian, God is helping you. How often have you looked back in your life at past experiences and said, you know, I couldn't see it at the time, but God was bringing me through. You ever done that? I didn't know it. I felt like I couldn't make it, but God brought me through. Can I ask you a question? Can we please stop waiting until it's over and looking back and just say in the moment, I know God is helping me. We just do that. Amen. Just know it then. Because He is. Well, how do you know that? Because the Word tells you. Because Jesus is our high priest. Jesus is our high priest. And the job of a high priest is to forgive us of sin and to help us in struggle. But we don't believe it. We don't believe it because we can't feel it, or we can't know it in a physical sense. Have you ever taken the word of an expert about something you didn't know about and acted on it, maybe in some really big way, even though you didn't know a thing about it? You ever done that? You know, I do this every time I take my car to the mechanic. And you have got four cars at our house. And at least one of those vehicles is over at my mechanic at least once a month. There's one up in there all the time. And so we pull it in there. He'll look at it. You know, sometimes I'll go back there with him. They'll pop the hood. We'll look at it together. He'll talk about what it is. Kind of what I was thinking, too, about that. I thought that was it, but I wanted to make sure. So I don't have a clue. So he'll call me up, and he'll say, "We found the problem. It's this, 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 and this." I would tell you what he says, but I don't know those words. I don't know any of that. So he'll say, "Here's what it is." I'll say, "Okay, let me sit down and take a deep breath. What's it going to cost?" And he tells me what it's going to cost. You know what I tell him? "Go ahead. Go ahead." I don't say to him, "Well, now listen, Shane. Yeah, we're on a first name basis, believe me. I've paid for so many vacations. I'm his favorite customer." So I don't say to him, "Shane, listen, I don't feel like that's the problem. Or I don't have personal knowledge, Shane, that that's the problem. So let's not do that. I'm not going to accept your word on that. I don't feel like that." That would be ridiculous. I will take the word of my doctor. I'll take the word of my mechanic. I will take the word of my handyman or home repairman. Why? Because I don't know. But he does. And yet, how many of us will look at an all-knowing God and say, "Well, you said the sins were forgiven, but I don't feel it. Or you said you'd help me in struggle, but I don't see it." That doesn't make any sense. He said it, and he does it. Finally, to notice again, the reason he's in heaven is so that he can condescend in order to give you the help that you need. He does that also by providing for our spiritual growth. Do you ever stop and appreciate how far you've come spiritually? Do you ever give yourself credit for your spiritual growth? Do you ever do that? Do you ever just sit for a moment and think, "You know, I may not be exactly where I need to be, but I've grown. I know something I didn't know before. I'm able to handle some things I haven't handled before. I've got some insight that I've never had." Do you ever do that? You know, most Christians I know don't do that. When most Christians talk about their spiritual growth, they're going to tell you how far they've got to go and how weak they are, what they don't know and what they can't do. Almost invariably. You need to take a minute. And you need to give yourself, I was going to say give yourself some credit, give God the credit and enjoy the blessing of having made some growth. But I also know for myself personally, I have a long way to go. I need to grow. And that growth, the Bible tells us, particularly in the book of Ephesians, is going to come from Jesus. Because Jesus is the head of the church. And wait a minute. Every time I've ever heard anybody talk about Jesus being the head of the church, they were saying, "He's the boss, you got to do what he says." That's true. Jesus is the head of the church, and you got to do everything he says. 100%. Absolutely. But do you know that in Ephesians chapter 4, Paul says there's more to it than that? That Jesus being the head of the church is about more than just bossing you around. Think about the human body. Did you realize that every single thing that is beneficial or growth-causing or improving to your physical body starts where? Starts in the head. Everything that your body does that is good or beneficial or growth causing comes from up here. So that if there is any sort of disconnect, and I don't mean physically to cut your head off, though that's an extreme example, but if there's any sort of disconnect between what's going on up here and what's happening down here, what happens? It either hurts you or it kills you because you're not connected correctly to the head. The same thing is true in the church. The same thing is true in the church. We're the church. If we, to whatever degree that we are disconnected from the head, who is Jesus, to that degree we will suffer and possibly spiritually die. We've got to stay connected. That begins with being intentional. You've got to make up your mind to stay connected. Do you ever feel at the end of a day or the end of a week, do you ever feel disconnected from your family? Do you ever feel disconnected from your family? Feel like I haven't connected. Feel like I really haven't talked to my spouse. I don't feel like I've spent time with my kids. Those are people who are physically present with you. And if you don't be intentional about connecting with them, you're not going to be connected. Jesus is in heaven. If you're not intentional about staying connected, you don't have a chance. So how do you do that? Three things, and then we'll wrap up and be done. Start out your morning with connection to Christ. Start out your morning. First thing in the morning, think about Him. Meditate on Him. Read a verse about Him. Dwell on Him. So make some connection. Talk to Him. That's biblical, by the way. Don't get wrapped around the axle. That is in the Bible. You can talk to Him. And then throughout the day, do something to remind yourself to stop for a moment and just think, am I still connected? If not, need to get connected. Your personal Bible study and prayer habit. Your personal Bible study and prayer habit. And you cannot stay connected to Christ without being part of His church. It's impossible. Jesus went to heaven, yes, to be exalted, and yes, to rule, so that He could give you the help that you need. Jesus is our King. Because He is our King, we can have peace, and we should be in prayer that He give us the peace that we need. He is our High Priest, so He gives us forgiveness. And the help that we need, He is the head of the church. We must obey Him. And we must look to Him for our spiritual growth. Jesus was exalted to rule in order so that He could condescend to serve. Now, next morning, Lord willing, we're going to begin a new series on how to get the most out of church. We're going to begin with singing. How to get the most out of our singing. It's not going to be what you think it is. How do we get the most from our time spent singing together? It's going to surprise you, the answer to that, but that's what we'll talk about, Lord willing. And then tonight, Lord willing, 6 o'clock, we're going to meet back here at the building for our monthly Sunday night Bible study, and we're going to be talking about what to do when things seem desperate. When it looks like it's desperate, what do we do about that? That's tonight, Lord willing, at 6. So here's what we've seen this month in our sermons. Jesus is God, eternal God, lived in heaven for eternity until He left heaven, entered into a physical body, and lived as a human. As that human, after accomplishing what He needed to accomplish on the earth, He went back and is presently in heaven now. And that's the end of the story, right? The end. Lived happily ever after. Is that where it ends? There's something else coming. And that is that Jesus is coming back. He is returning. And when He returns, He is going to destroy the physical universe. You're not going to be able to live here anymore. Right? You can't say, well, you know, Jesus, I see You coming back, but I'd just rather stay here if You don't mind. I like the way I've been. There's not going to be an option. It's destroyed. Everything's destroyed. There's going to be a judgment. And Jesus, after the judgment, is going to take His people into heaven to be with Him forever. That's where we're headed. And then, figuratively speaking, he's going to bar the gate. And even if you wanted to, you couldn't get out. Not that you want to. You'll never lose your salvation. And nothing can get in to harm you. My family gives me a hard time. A lot. But particularly about some, what they see as quirky behavior. I know is normal. They think is quirky. But one thing I'm really obsessive about is a locked door. I'm obsessive about a locked door. I check it constantly. And I used to, whenever I would get home, right, at the time that I made this change, there were five of us living at home. And no matter what time of day it was, if I came home, I would lock the door and latch it. Right, we got one of those latches where if you open it, you open this much, you can't open it, right? And so I would latch it. Well, there's still family members out and about. So they'd come home, they'd unlock the door. They're not expecting you. And so they're expecting just to open the door, but it's latched. Stagger back, hollering the door, "Dad, open the door." And boy, and finally they just kept on about it. Why do you do that? Why do you do that? We're out. We're coming back. Leave it unlatched. So finally, I fought it, and I did. I fight it every day. Every time I pass the door and it's unlatched, it just within me, it just, but I do it because they asked me to. Door is unlatched all day. But my favorite part of the day, my favorite part of every day, when everybody who can be in is in, guess what I do? I latch the door. I'm getting chills right now just thinking about it. I can't tell you how happy that makes me. Because now, everybody who's supposed to be in here is in here. And nobody who's not supposed to be in here can get in here. Nobody who can hurt my family can get in here because the door is latched. That's the happiest part of my day. Can you imagine what it's going to be like after the judgment when we, the people of God, are taken by Jesus into heaven? And we turn back and look, and Jesus is latching the door. Everybody who's supposed to be here is here, and nobody who can do any harm can ever get in. I can't wait for that day. Can't wait for that day. Question is, are you ready for that day? Are you ready? He's coming back. Listen. I know it's been 2,000 years since Jesus said, "Look, y'all, I'll be back." But it's coming. And there's going to be a judgment. And the only question that you're going to care about at that time is not how many zeros was I making? What kind of car was I driving? What can I watch tonight on TV? What am I going to have for supper? What's that pain in my lower back? You're not going to think about that. When Jesus comes back and you're standing in judgment, the only thing you're going to be concerned about is what? Am I ready? Am I ready? Are you ready? If you aren't, let's make it right. We're going to sing this song in just a moment. 771? 318. 318. Number 318. We're going to sing that. Get that ready. And we're going to sing that in just a moment. The only question I would like for you to be asking yourself, the only thing you need to be thinking is, am I ready? And if you aren't, we can fix that. So you can decide, all right, I'm not ready. I'm going to go talk to somebody after church. Or, can't wait that long, want to be sure it gets done. I'm going to do it now. So as they're singing the song, you decide you're not ready, you can let us know, talk to us privately after church, or you can come forward and take a seat on the front as we stand and sing.